Welcome to Funny They Don't Look Jewish, where Judaism appears in the panels. Our purpose is to find characters, stories, and issues of comics that explore explicitly Jewish content. I'm Brandon Bernstein.
I'm Henry Bernstein.
No relation. Hey, Henry, we're in person. It's good to see you.
We're hugging right now.
Wow. I am here visiting Chicago, and we took it as an excuse to come back from one of our infamous and many breaks and hiatuses on this podcast. But we're back. How's life?
Life is great. I can't believe you're here in person.
It's really nice.
It's funny because we were talking before that it's not just that it's been a long time since we've had a show, which has been several months. Well, like you said, one of our many hiatus. But I don't think we've recorded in person, seeing each other, sitting next to each other, since maybe January 2020.
Yeah, like when we recorded all the Moon Knight stuff that got released over like the months to follow. But I think, yeah, it might have been Moon Knight that we got together, which is, it's wild.
Yeah, that's crazy. So I hope we remember how to do this in person.
Yeah, I think we'll be okay.
It's so awkward that we're not behind the screen right now.
I mean, I'm loving it because I'm not hidden in like a closet,
right?
in someone's house anymore. But here we are. Speaking of like common occurrences, we keep having hiatuses and breaking up, but there's also a sense we're keeping like, well, we must be getting towards the end of the Jewish content. Surely there's no new characters. And then there's a character that like we were aware of, but we didn't quite realize just how much Jewish content was there. And that's the character we're covering today. Henry, who are we looking at?
Today we're looking at Seraph, created by E. Nelson Bridwell and Ramona Fraden. And I have kind of a recent history with this. This, I was, like you said, we knew about the character, but I was sort of alerted to it, his explicit Judaism, through some very righteous Gentiles, particularly my friend Rob Kelly, who hosts the podcast For All Mankind, which goes through every issue of Super Friends, which we're going to cover shortly.
Amazing. Yeah, the comic based on the cartoon. I have to say, when I think back to my childhood, I am constantly, one of my nostalgic memories is watching like either Cartoon Network or Boomerang, right? Yeah. That show that was just like, it's all coming back, and all the old cartoons. And I would watch these Super Friends and Challenge of the Super Friends marathons over and over again, and got to know all of them. And I always like loved the, I think Cartoon Network, you'd like take them and do these silly videos with Toy Man being like, I love toys, and Scarecrow and all these villains. Yeah. But like Super Friends was sort of, that was one of my early introductions to DC characters because I was a Marvel guy, but I would watch Super Friends. And so I've always had this love for the sort of like ultra clean cut, very cheery 70s cartoon style of the Super Friends. And now we're going to be looking at the comics that were based on them.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, I just wanted to share some gratitude to Rob for bringing me on his show to talk about Seraph and alerting me to, that caused me to alert you, and so we could explore how Jewish this character actually is.
Yeah, if you haven't heard it, it's a great episode. I highly recommend it. It's so fun to hear Henry representing us in conversation with others, and there's just like so much kavod, so much respect in terms of your kavod for them for all their Super Friends knowledge, but their kavod for you. Like, it was really cool to hear them be so excited to get some like insider Jewish tips on like what was going on there.
Well, Rob and I joke several times, he's had me on many times, that I'm like his, I'm like his most super Jewish friend.
So listeners, if you never watched it, the Super Friends involved, you know, sort of the main core Justice League, as well as these strange alien twins that could transform, known as the Wonder Twins. And sometimes the roster got international and giant, and there were all these different characters from different countries. Like, I seem to remember Samurai, who he would like whirl around like a tornado, from what I recall, something like that. So there were all these sort of,
he has a superpowers toy, by the way.
So there's all these like Kenner superpowers toys based on the Super Friends. So once the cartoon introduced the idea of a different superhero from each country, DC of course ended up in the comics making an Israeli superhero who is explicitly Jewish. This is not too dissimilar from what Marvel would later do in the 80s when they created Sabra, of course, coming out of the Contest of Champions, which also was taking advantage of the idea of, let's have superheroes from all these different countries. And so Marvel and DC, as always, are like copying each other. Both of them end up deciding to create a hero to represent the relatively new country at that time. I mean, 30 years, but yeah, still fairly new. Right. The country of Israel, by having Sabra and Marvel. But way before this, in 1977, Seraph.
The first comic we're looking at is Super Friends number 7, July 1977. So if we're talking about 1977, that officially makes him, Seraph, the longest running canonically Jewish character, because it predates both Kitty Pryde and Colossal Boy.
Yeah, he definitely predates both of them. It's
by a couple years.
I think, yeah, by like 2 years. I think Kitty Pryde, I keep going back and reviewing. Yeah. No, Kitty Pryde really like appeared first in like mid-1979. So we're talking about like 2 years beforehand. It's interesting that you say continuous, because as we'll discuss a little later, he has a bunch of early appearances and then kind of disappears for decades at a time. So I don't know if he's like, I mean, we've covered characters in the past, Henry, who are C-list and D-list, but like,
oh, this is
like Z-list.
Oh yeah, yeah, this is really low. I mean, we haven't, like you said, we haven't seen him for a long time. But what I meant, I guess, my longest running, I mean, in our first episode when we talked about The Thing, who really isn't canonically Jewish till 2002,
right?
This predates that by more than 30 years. So what I'm saying is that is he our first Jewish, officially canonically Jewish superhero that we've discovered at this point?
At this point, as far as mainstream, meaning Marvel or DC superheroes, yes, I think he is the earliest instance of an established as Jewish character, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
it is. He's just like in this like pocket continuity, because as we know, DC loves having many universes, and the Super Friends comics take place in this like parallel or side earth.
Yeah, it's its own thing.
Yeah. So Henry, before we dive into this issue though, let's talk about a few things.
Yeah.
I'm just going to acknowledge, so his name is Seraph, which means that he's named directly after a Hebrew term for a type of angel. We were actually double checking this right before the podcast. So a seraph is a type of ministering angel. Maimonides ends up listing the seraphim as being the fifth of 10 ranks of angels. And various aspects of Kabbalah are going to view the seraphim as coming from the world of Bria, being sort of the first world created out of Atzilut, out of oneness with God. And so being like about as close to oneness with God as possible. The seraphim are the types of angels referred to in Isaiah's vision. If anyone's ever looked in Isaiah 6 at the image of these six winged angels that cover themselves in this really wild face, in this really wild way. So these are the seraphim, but the Hebrew word seraph as a verb can also mean like to burn. So these are burning angels. They're like these fiery angels, which makes them kind of badass, and I think popular for lots of different types of art. Mm-hmm. These are not cute little cherubim. Or bizarre wheels spinning from Ezekiel. These are like these like burning many winged angels. So that's the word. But let's talk a little bit about Seraph's creator, by which I do not mean Hashem above, but rather the writer E. Nelson Bridwell.
Yeah, E. Nelson Bridwell, just a wonderful DC Comics writer. And the first thing, of course, I looked up was is he Jewish?
Right.
Is
he?
Unfortunately, he's not. However, according to Paul Kupperberg, one of our favorite Jewish writers who wrote those Supergirl issues that we covered, said he had an encyclopedic mind and was an expert on not only DC's history and continuity, but the Bible and works of Shakespeare themselves. So, like, that is to say, not Jewish, incredibly knowledgeable in all things. And like he was known as the the continuity king or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Bible and the works of Shakespeare, you can probably make like most references in the English language. Like, I just feel like there's like a period of time where those are probably the two most referenced collected works that exist.
Right. That like Greek stuff, the classics, things like that.
Which, he might know the Odyssey and the Iliad backwards.
I'm sure
and forwards.
He does. Who knows?
Great. So he clearly has it. And as we're going to uncover, as we look into it, there's definitely some times where I'm like, yes, he's memorized a Bible. It does not sound like Tanakh to me. It definitely sounds like the way that Christians talk about the Christian Bible, but we'll get into it as we go.
Right.
All right. So, Henry, let's just dive in. You already said it's number seven, but give us the details about Super Friends number seven.
This is Super Friends number seven, July 1977. The Warning of the Wonder Twins.
Ooh.
Written by E. Nelson Bridwell, penciled by Ramona Fraden, inked by Bob Smith, edited by Denny O'Neill.
Great. So we pick up on page six of our issue. The Super Friends have split up to do various tasks, and Superman has gone to Israel to dismantle a bomb. And just out of nowhere, we see that he's hanging out with a guy named the Seraph. And before we get introduced to all the many wonderful items that's listed, which I'm just thinking, like, where does he get all those wonderful toys? Henry, since you have such a love for the visual side of things, can you just describe for our listeners who probably cannot picture Seraph, even if they Googled him, like, what does this guy look like?
So in this, the way Ramona Fraden drew him, he's already seems bigger than Superman.
Yeah, giant dude.
He's a huge dude. He is wearing a purple and yellow yarmulke on top of a sort of Dutch boy haircut with a beard, massive build, and what looks like a purple sash over his chest and a skirt or some sort of biblical attire.
Yeah, like a tunic of sorts.
But he has a Jewish star belt connecting them.
And it's sort of with the sash and the way it's coming down, it's like if you know that 90s Jim Lee Cyclops design where there's the sort of like the yellow belt sashing up over his body and then like connecting to the belt at the bottom, like that's where the Star of David is.
Yeah.
And also he's, of course, Seraph is bare-chested on the part that's not covered by his sash, but showing off his physique. I love, like you said, the colors. He looks very, very either royal or Lakers colors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then he's also carrying this big staff, and we're going to find out what it is. So the Seraph lets us know what he has. Superman checks in asking, like, oh, you're wearing the mantle of the prophet Elijah.
Because, of course, Superman knows all about the mantle of the prophet Elijah.
He's familiar with Kiddush.
Yeah, it's true.
He's familiar with these things. Yeah. So, so this is Elijah's mantle in Hebrew, Aderet, so the Aderet Shiloh, which we see appearing throughout the Book of Kings whenever Elijah appears. One aspect we wanted to bring up and point your attention to is in 2 Kings chapter 2, especially verse 8, Elijah takes his mantle and sort of like wraps it up, like whips it up and strikes the Jordan River, causing it to split. He's like Moses. He can just split water with this mantle. And in fact, the Italian commentator Sforno writes regarding the Exodus that the way Moses splits the sea is like Elijah, not Elijah being like Moses, which is very cool. And this is done right before Elijah is one of two figures in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, that is infamous for the fact that he doesn't die. He just ascends to heaven. He gets taken up by a whirlwind, leaving Elisha, his sort of buddy in prophecy, behind. And Elisha sort of gets Elijah's powers and spirit. And Elisha lifts up the mantle, also strikes the river and makes the Jordan split, which sort of seems to be the implication that it's not Elijah inherently who has these powers, but rather the powers may be associated with the mantle. So I think that's sort of what E. Nelson is using to suggest that the mantle's been passed down from prophet to prophet to prophet. Is Seraph a prophet? I don't know, but he's got magic powers because of this mantle. Not only that, but he has Moses's rod, the one coming all the way from Exodus 7, although initially it's Aaron who wields the staff or the rod. The rod of Moses, infamously known, right? You may be familiar with the idea that in the Haggadah, there is no mention of Moses whatsoever, with the exception of one slight allusion, that being to a staff or a rod, and that, of course, being Moses' rod. So at this point, Seraph has two ways of splitting seas. He has both Moses' rod and the mantle. He also has Solomon's ring. And if you're thinking to yourself, I've never heard of Solomon's ring in the Tanakh, you are not wrong. It does not exist in the Tanakh. The earliest reference that I am aware of would be from our buddy Josephus, the historian from Roman times. There's also allusions to it within Sefer HaRazim, or the Book of Mysteries, the Book of Secrets, the Book of Hints, which is a 3rd century magical text, but not really a canonical one. So, so far, it's a lot of like, this sounds like
canonical in the Torah, not in comics.
Exactly. As we know, everything that is outside the canon of the Torah is ripe for comic book play. I love having that stuff. But the only like sort of sanctioned awareness that we have of it is in the Babylonian Talmud in Gittin 68a to b. We get into a conversation about what else? Demons. And basically, there's the rabbis are talking about how Solomon at one point tried to like capture Ashmodai, the king of demons. And the way that he did that is he ended up getting a number of objects that were engraved with God's name in order to be able to capture Ashmodai. And one of them was a ring, and the ring had God's name engraved in it. So I assume this is the same Solomon's ring, but if you get into like occultism and sort of Western esotericism, there's a lot of books of magic that are going to reference the ring of Solomon or Solomon's ring. Is it Jewish at this point? Like
Jewish adjacent.
Jewish adjacent. Jewish adjacent. And finally, it's not an object, but Seraph doesn't hesitate to let us know his long hair gives him great strength, just like Samson's. This being a story to Samson the Nazarite, whose vow gives him super strength and lets him be an enemy of the Philistines and a protector of the Israelites. So we get this like a mishmash amalgamation of a bunch of Jewish biblical items, giving him all these many toys and superpowers.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, Brandon.
It's fine. I've got something to put you on the spot later, too.
Do any of the items that he has, are they duplicates or are they the same items that Ramban has?
I'm pretty sure Ramban also has Moses and staff.
Right? That's what I thought. Yeah. So are there two staffs or are they lending it to each other?
Lokasha, this is not a problem, Henry. As the Talmud would say, here, when referencing Ramban, we are in the primary DC continuity. And here, when referencing Seraph, we are in an alternate world where he has it. So I don't think, although we'll get to it at the very end, for the most part, these two characters do not appear in the same realities. So it seems to be, there's going to be a resolution.
At least in today's episode.
At least in today's episode, they don't. So I think that's the only answer we have.
Okay.
All right. On page 7, Superman's been trapped, oh no, in a gravitational field. And as we may know, what's one of Superman's weaknesses besides kryptonite, Henry?
Magic.
So he needs the mystical Seraph to help. Seraph consults the ring of wit Solomon. Of course, Solomon's known for being very wise. So I guess the ring contains all his wisdom. We get a nice footnote from E. Nelson, who refers to himself as the Big E. Henry, what does our footnote say?
The ring is not mentioned in the Bible. It comes from Hebrew traditions.
Love it. Love the fact that he's telling us this. This is true. Listeners, if any of you know more about the Ring of Solomon and want to educate us, we'd love to learn. But the narration refers to Seraph as the Hebrew hero. Love the alliteration. And of course, Seraph is able to use his rod or Moses' staff to clear a path to the bomb, help out Superman. And he helpfully tells Superman, Moses used the rod like this when he parted the Red Sea. So we're going to get used to this. It's a lot of like references to the biblical figures and sort of saying like, this is what they did. I copy them, which is a bit of a shame, but that's it. That's our first issue. He just pops up and Superman heads off to what's next. What do you make of this first appearance of Seraph?
Well, I'm going to like anything where his first appearance is with Superman. It kind of gives it the stamp of approval that like in his first appearance, he's with Superman, not like, you know, pulling Aquaman out of the, Dead Sea or something.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, he's okay, legit.
Henry, that's so funny. The idea of like, Aquaman's like, trying to shut down. I'm floating and it's burning me. I don't like this water. Seraph just like.
I don't know if you know this, but there's like maybe you remember this from when you were a kid watching Super Friends, but like, they would have to create something having to do with water so that Aquaman would have something to do.
Every time. Yeah, it's like that was the joke. Like, you know, I think we both grew up enjoying Wizard Magazine and its spinoff Toy Fair. And one of the things that they would do was they would often like put the toys in funny pages and give like words to it. Right. And one of the repeating jokes was the idea of like Aquaman always being like, if we move to the ocean, I could help. Right. Like, things like that. Yeah, the other thing that I was just thinking about, as you mentioned it, did you ever read Jonathan Hickman's Avengers run from like 2011, 2000? Yeah, it's the run that a lot of Infinity, like the Children of Thanos came out of that from the MCU, right? Mm-hmm. So in that, Jonathan Hickman brings Hyperion onto the Avengers, and Hyperion is from the Squadron Supreme, mm-hmm. which is basically Marvel's version of the Justice League.
Right.
So Hyperion is like Superman, but you know, a parody of Superman, not in a funny way, just in like a it's Marvel Superman more or less. Although there's multiple ones. Anyway, Hyperion and Thor develop this amazing bromance because they both just like, they're honorable warriors who love going to battle, and they're often like shirtless and fighting and doing all this stuff. And so like, I kind of felt that same vibe from Superman and Seraph here, where it's just like, oh, these are like bros in the world of like, we're both, they're both incredibly kind, incredibly nice, incredibly powerful, and they want to like save the world and do it in the right way. Like, you very much get the sense from his future appearances also that Seraph is like
a good guy.
He's a good guy in the way Superman is.
Right.
He's very much a mensch. It's like, no, I'm not going to do, you know, like, we're going to do good things and we're going to uphold. We believe in the best in people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So to answer your original question is I really enjoyed this first appearance.
It was,
and you know, we kind of glossed over it a little bit, but I just want to say that little footnote, although it's, you know, we can interpret it how we want in terms of, you know, as part of the Hebrew tradition, I really appreciate the effort there to point out this is not in the Bible.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Because anyone can just throw anything out. And like you said, anything that's not in the Bible is up for fair game in a comic. So someone actually might read it and be like, oh, I didn't know that was a thing. But if it's not in the Bible and you're actually being told that, okay, then I can interpret different things. Maybe I care more about like what is in the Bible.
Right. We're both Jewish educators. So of course we care more about that. It reminds me of the same way of like, sometimes it's frustrating. Like, I know people who know Midrash and know commentaries and know that, but they don't know what's what. And so it's like, sometimes I remember when I lived in Crown Heights, I would like go and have dinner with some Chabadniks and kind of talk to their kids. And they would talk about like, you know, the Midrash about Jacob studying in the yeshiva of Shem the Ever, right? Which is like a commentary and a Midrash. But for them, it's like, no, this is like from Torah.
Right.
Or, you know, if you talk to some people, they might be shocked that the idea of Abraham smashing the idols of his father is not in the Torah, right? It's a Midrash. It's a Drash. I love Drash, and I do accept it as being like influential and in changing how I think about these figures and my tradition. But it's really important to know what layer everything is from,
right?
It's like really critical. And I love that, right? Like, clearly E. Nelson also is like, you know, he has an encyclopedic knowledge for a reason, because he like values knowing with precision what from where.
Right. So I just didn't want to gloss over that. Thank you.
Appreciate for indulging it. Me. Yeah. Well, he doesn't appear again for roughly 2 years, until like literally 2 years later in July 1979, Super Friends number 25. So this is like 18 issues later. Puppets of the Overlord, once again, written by E. Nelson Bridwell, penciled by Ramona Fraden, inked by Bob Smith, colored by Gene D'Angelo, and edited by Julius Schwartz. Henry, let's take us through this issue.
So in this, the previously mentioned Wonder Twins are brainwashed by a villain, and they're trying to take over the Arabian Peninsula. And who should show up but Seraph?
Hey! Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like he's in the Middle East. He can come by. Why not?
And the panel that he appears in on page 11, he just, the way the perspective is drawn, because it's such a small panel, it looks like he's a giant and they're like teeny weeny.
Right. And it's very funny because the Wonder Twins have been like talking in English and they're just like, we don't care that we're in the Arabian Peninsula. You must understand English. And of course, Seraph is like, oh, I understand English.
Exactly.
So they recognize him, Henry. And what do they say?
Zan says, he is said to have the strength of Samson. Samson killed a lion with his bare hands. And then Jaina says, and 1,000 men with the jawbone of an ass. By the way, kids comic.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, it really just means a donkey. Yeah. So we don't need to belabor the point, but these are indeed accurate biblical references. If you're interested in the story of Samson killing a lion, you can check out Judges 14, verses 5 and 6. And if you would like to read about Samson slaying 1,000 men with a donkey's jawbone, check out Judges 15, verse 15.
And you know, in Judges chapters 14 and 15, I mean, the story of Samson is really short.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so it's when it's read in the weekly Haftorah, it's over 2 weeks, the whole right. story, and that's it.
And like so much of the Tanakh, right, there's like these stories that you're shocked are so short because it just like it's so captivating to the imagination, right. Like there's so much there of like, who is this? He really is like an Israeli or Israelite superhero.
He's the first superhero. That's what he is. That's what his job is as a Nazirite. It's like, you grow your hair long, you refrain from drinking wine, and you make an oath to God, and then you get powers. You get superpowers.
Right. You get superpowers.
And not everyone who is a Nazirite in the Torah has the superpowers. He seems to be the only one.
Which, I mean, that's based on because of his mother, right? His mother vowing to dedicate him from birth. Like, I don't think there's any other Nazirite from birth, because usually you have to make the vow, which means you have to be conscious and able to like say it. But like, that's an instance of like a mother making the vow on his behalf.
Right. And it even in the Torah, in the Tanakh, it says the only translation of it is to vow a vow. Basically, it's the same word.
Right. The word Nazir for Nazirite.
Right. Right. So, you know, I just think that's really interesting to like use the original superhero as the basis for your superhero. And what I found, Brandon, in over the years of as I taught judges in this particular story, and I taught when I used to teach, I taught the Book of Numbers, which really talks about the Nazirite and the laws of the Nazirite. Most of the media that for kids about Samson is from Christian educational stuff. Like, right. There are a couple different animated Samson movies, like, you know, not quite as high quality as the Prince of Egypt, but like they're all Christian. They're both Christian. So I think, you know, when you read the Book of Judges, and you know, this is way off topic, maybe it's not, I don't know, but Samson's not a good guy. He's a jackass.
He's kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
Right? And which, again, kind of like Marvel Hercules.
So, right. I mean, he sort of acts like a Greek god, not a person who has, you know, oathed himself, vowed himself to God. So, you know, this sort of myth that he's a superhero, actually, that's, I think, isn't necessarily a Jewish idea. Like, anytime I've learned about Samson when I was a kid, and certainly teaching it, like there are very few redeeming things other than his final act of bringing the walls down and killing more people. So I don't even know how great
the dude loves murder.
Yeah. So anyway, that's
funny.
All I wanted to say.
I was gonna say, my earliest introduction to Samson, from what I could recall, maybe I learned about him also in Hebrew school, but my earliest was, do you know the singer Neil Sedaka? He has a song called Run Samson Run. It's the story of like Samson and Delilah. And my parents used to play that album all the time. So I think that's actually my first, like my earliest consistent memory of Samson is like from that song, which at least Neil Sedaka was like a nice Jewish boy. So,
And also, by the way, the Grateful Dead would place the song Samson and Delilah on Sunday and their Sunday shows.
Oh, love it.
Because it's like, you're going to see the dead, you go to church.
Right. So like, clearly, like Samson is just this, like, he's one of those pop culture biblical like transfers, right? Like, he's just like a known character in a lot of pop culture, although maybe not so much in the past 30, 40 years. All right. So they're intimidated by him. What happens on page 12?
They transform, because that's what they do. Those are their powers. And it stops the brainwashing. So Seraph uses the Ring of Solomon to transport them to Batman.
Because they're trying to get the crew together.
Right.
And all the Justice League is brainwashed. So it's like Superman's brainwashed, Batman's brainwashed, everybody's brainwashed. And they're trying to de-brainwash them one by one.
Right. And then he uses his ring to make Batman change back into Bruce Wayne. So this ring now is just like,
it can do whatever.
Yeah.
I also love the idea. It's like, okay, the Wonder Twins actually transform. That makes sense. But I love the idea that he like transforms Batman. Like, he just pointed the ring and the ring was like, change from Batman costume. Yeah. So like Bruce Wayne, like, it's not really a transformation. They're gathering all the heroes and they're like, well, the only way we're going to survive this is by learning everyone's secret identity. And Seraph very sweetly is like, I haven't earned knowing it. And so he decides to leave. He says shalom and just heads out to leave them. So I love that he like comes in and starts it and then like leaves it.
Ring, take me home.
Right. Which it's just nice to see like this sort of like you know, similar to Moses, this humility, this anava, and right. in the figure that it's like, he doesn't need to be there for the end. He just does his part and heads out.
Dan and Jaina are so annoying to me. And I went on a little rant about them on this For All Mankind podcast. You could hear about, I know they're not a favorite of anyone. And I still to this day don't understand. Like, why did they waste their time with those two when they could have had like Hawkman and Green Arrow or Black Canary? Like, why did they have to have these stupid, or even if they needed to have kids, have a couple Titans on there? You know, Robin was already there, so you put you know, Cyborg and Beast Boy on there.
I don't know, it's from like a long-standing tradition. I know it's different, but it makes me think, in the original Fantastic Four cartoon, they worried that Human Torch would be a bad influence on children because kids would want to set themselves on fire. And so they introduced the Fantastic Four's robot helper Herbie, that became like part of the cart. It was Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Woman, The Thing, and Herbie.
Right.
And then Herbie ended up coming over into the comics. And so, you know, similar, I don't know, I guess it's like the Wonder Twins just become this kid friendly. I mean, we haven't mentioned it, right? But the Wonder Twins also have their like blue monkey friend.
Yeah.
Gleek. Then Gleek. Right.
They're just, it just annoys me that like this guy is, who's clearly a hero, who clearly knows Superman from back in the day. Who knows how long they've been buddies? Because Superman's just like, I'm going to go fly to Israel to talk to this guy. Like, he clearly already has a relationship.
Yeah,
and his first appearance. But so Zan and Jaina can know everyone's secret identities, but Seraph's like, no, I'm good. I don't need to.
But he chooses it, right?
Right.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we are, in the interest of actually keeping things a little shorter this time.
Yeah, moving things along.
We're just going to do one more issue, and you know, we'll pick up with more of Seraph in part two. But Henry, tell us the details about our last issue for today.
So this is the issue that I talked about on For All Mankind. So if you want to hear more about the Super Friends type stuff and some other conversations about that, you can go check that out at the Fire and Water Podcasting Network, For All Mankind number 38. Anyway, this is Super Friends number 38, August 1980, The Seraph's Day of Atonement, written by E. Nelson Bridwell, penciled by Bob Ochsner, inked by Kim DeMolder, colored by Jerry Serpy, lettered by Milt Snappen, and edited by Julius Schwartz.
Yeah, so we're 13 issues after our last one, and Ramona Freyden, the creator, is off the book, it seems.
Yeah.
So we're getting, you know, we're basically now in the start of, it's really cool. Basically, there are Super Friends issues that have whatever the main story is, and then we get these backup issues, and every comic has a different backup issue. And we're ending today with one, but we're going to have two more that feature Seraph. And it really feels, I think you talked about this with your friends on For All Mankind, it really feels like E. Nelson Bridwell had like a lot of love for Seraph over some of the other characters, perhaps. Like, it really feels like he's really going to go deep into the character.
Absolutely.
Point. All right, so let's get into it. Page one, we get what's going to become the routine review of all his powers and toys. Elijah's mantle, Solomon's ring, Moses' staff, Samson's strength. This is the core four elements of Seraph. There's actually something nice about four. Anytime there's fours in Judaism, I do think, like, you know, like the Tetragrammaton, God's four-letter name, like, fours are meaningful. So, like, I like
the
that
four
he has
matriarchs.
The four aspects, the four matriarchs, the four questions, the four cups, right? Like,
yeah.
But anytime you have fours in Judaism, especially mystically, it's like one for each letter of God's name. So there is something nice there.
We have the Hebraic lettering.
We have all Seraph's name is written in Hebraic lettering, as you might see in our own podcast title, right. Or of course, as I often think, tourist t-shirts everywhere where it's American language trying to look like Hebrew. Page one, we are in the land of Israel, and in his secret identity, which I don't think we've known until now, we get a man driving up to a construction site. This man is Chaim Lavon. Great name. Love that it's Chaim.
That's my Hebrew name.
Love it. And a very attractive woman welcomes him and saying, Shalom. And we find out Chaim, in his civilian identity, is a teacher who has been assigned to a new settlement in the land of Israel. And he's meeting a woman named Rivka Sharet, the founder of the settlement. Henry, I love that the caption lets us know explicitly that this settlement is not in disputed territory, meaning that it is not part of the territories that were captured in 1967 in the Six-Day War. The settlements in those territories, by the way, started as early as September 1967, because I was wondering when it said that, like, oh, what does it mean, territories? What's going on here? Obviously, there were settlements throughout the land of Israel as the country was developing. But in this case, the settlements that are in those territories that were captured in 1967, they start as early as September. And this is just a fun fact that I found while doing research. The basis for the settlements is in something called the Alon Plan, which is named so after Yigal Alon. And eagle-eared listeners may be aware that Yigal Alon was the member of Knesset that Paul Levitz referenced as the reason he made Colossal Boy Jewish, because his name is Gim or Jim Alon. So we have like a nice little like tie-up on the DC's Jewish superheroes. Page two, Chaim is getting to know the members of the settlement. It's weird. I keep wanting it to be a kibbutz, but it's not a kibbutz. No. It's like a settlement. But he's getting to know people. He's getting to know the children. He's getting to know these elderly couple. It's very sweet. He's like felling over the elderly couple that are bragging to him how they made sure to learn Hebrew before coming to the Holy Land. They're so excited to speak the language of the ancestors. But then, of course, on an eight-page story, trouble has to rise quickly. So we see this group of bandits that are getting ready to attack. We don't know why, but we know they're pretending to be Arab. So we're going to skip forward to page four, where Chaim transforms into the Seraph. No care at all who's around.
He doesn't find a phone booth or anything.
No, he doesn't hide behind a car or a construction vehicle. He's just like, boom, I'm transforming. And basically, like, literally transforms in front of Rivka and, like, doesn't care, which, like, this comic came out in 1980. That has to be radical. Like, superheroes' secret identities were very much the norm in 1980. Right. Like, I don't think we'd begun to deconstruct that yet.
Right. I mean, even, you know, we were looking at comics in the last couple episodes from this era, and that was like so important. Like, remember how surprised I was that Captain America cared about his secret identity?
Right.
And, you know, so it's kind of interesting.
It's kind of interesting, yeah. But it shows that, like, he has a different way of being about it.
Right. Because she flat out says, Reb Lavon, you are the Seraph, the miracle worker.
Right. Like people have heard of him.
Yeah, he is. He's Israel's superhero. Right.
Which, I mean, I guess that's kind of the way Israeli society works. Like, oh, I had no idea you were this person I've heard of. I think there's kind of the sense of like the smallness of Israel.
Right.
But yeah, he fights these bandits.
Wait, and I'm sorry. Oh. And he explicitly says, yes, it is not a secret I've tried to conceal. Like,
right.
He's like, I don't care.
Right. He doesn't care at all. I love the idea that he's just like, yeah, like people might not pay attention,
right.
May or may not know, right. But like, I'm not stressed one, you know, he's like, I'm not pressed one way or another, right. If they know or don't.
That's a little bit of like a Clark Kent Superman at it. Like, I'm not putting on a mask and I'm not making myself
right
known. I mean, he does care if people see it is identity, but you know, the sort of the trusting in humanity.
Yeah. Also, it just dawned on me, like, how wonderful is it that if Seraph is sort of Jewish Superman, and I know many of our listeners might be like, they view Superman himself as
Superman
Jewish,
is Jewish, right?
Like,
Superman.
Like, yeah. You know that, but yeah. Given that, like, part of the premise of our podcast is we look for explicit Judaism, right. Not implied or suggested. So if Seraph is sort of this Jewish super soldier, superhero, Superman, how lovely is it that in his civilian identity, whether secret or not, he's not a reporter. He's not a rich billionaire.
Right.
What is he? He's an educator.
Teacher. Yeah.
That like says something really beautiful about Judaism and that sort of sense of like learning is what's important.
And
teaching.
And it's not, they didn't just go right to he's a rabbi.
Right.
Also,
right.
He's a teacher.
He's a teacher and a teacher of children.
Right.
He's not a college professor or lecturer, right? He's like, he cares.
He's a grade school teacher. Yeah. Or something.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's great.
God. All right. So on page five, he's fighting these guys, and one of them threatens to leave Seraph, quote, flat as a matzah, which may be my favorite threat I've ever heard. I will desperately be looking for ways to work flat as a matzah into my vocabulary going forward, Henry. Seraph ends up lifting a motorcycle with just one hand. We have this great moment where one of the attackers is like Hercules, and Seraph's response, what's he respond?
No, like Samson.
Love it. That's I so love good. The reorientation
yeah.
of the reference point. Right. So I mentioned this to you off mic, but I want to share it for everybody here. I don't think I've shared this story on podcast before, but during my year in Israel, I will never forget, there was an American rabbi who had made Aliyah, who was lecturing us at one point. And it's very telling. I remember the story. I don't remember his name. I don't remember what he was talking to us about. But I mean, I remember overall, his message was just sort of like, there's something different when you grow up in Israel, because Judaism is the mainstream culture. Not saying like religiously, right. but like, what does it mean to be in a society where Jewish reference points are your natural reference points, right. not Christian or secular American ones. And so the example he gave was a time that he was at his friend's house, or his friend was at his house, whatever it was, and there was an ant infestation. They're trying to get to the bottom of it, and they find it's under the sink, and they open the cabinets, and there's like this ant hill, and all of a sudden just a bunch of ants come pouring out, swarm of ants coming out. And as they see all of them like rushing out, the American who made Aliyah is like, whoa, it's like a stampede. Because as he pointed out, his reference point are all these Western movies that he grew up watching, where there'd be all the cattle would go running and there's a stampede. His Israeli friend sees it and goes, whoa, ze yitziat Mitzrayim. Wow. It's like the Exodus from Egypt. Right? Like that was his reference point of so many people rushing out. And that's what I feel like with this, that there's sort of this attempt of like the outsider non-Jewish world would be like, oh, what does it mean to have someone who's so strong they could lift up a motorcycle just like Hercules? And it's like, no, in this, in Israel, where we have Jewish reference points, it's like Samson. I love it.
It's awesome.
Page six, Seraph makes the ground quake. They discover there's a treasure house below. Turns out this is why the attackers are there. They knew about it. It supposedly has treasures hidden by Solomon in this treasure house built by Solomon, according to an ancient clay tablet. Seraph knows that these are guys only pretending to be Arab because he recognizes the accents are wrong. I also have to say, this is 1980. This is after the Six-Day War, after the Yom Kippur War. It's a little bit before the first Lebanon War. But like, given the situation, the choice here to not make Arabs the bad guys, but to make people like playing into the tensions, but pretending to be Arab, but not being, I actually think that that's like a really like savvy, smart, like I really like that decision. I like the fact that we're not getting a like Jews versus Arabs story, even though it's acknowledging that like the political realities there's tension.
There is, we talked about this one for a moment, kind of there is a lot of sort of second level conversation happening in this story. Like this is not just a kid's backup story. Like this is, even just at the beginning where he goes out of his way to say that this settlement is not in a disputed territory. Like if anyone read it, who cares? Like they wouldn't even notice.
Right.
But he made a point to say like, we don't have to talk about that as a conversation. We actually don't have to talk about it now because this is in a different place.
Right.
But if you want to have a conversation about it, you can go look in something else. You can go look it up to see what that's about. And hear the same thing, that like, it's just, he goes out of his way to these extra little story things that like, you'd think that I would make the Arabs the bad guy, but no, that is a stereotype that people read, and we're not going to do that. We'll do something else. Yeah.
I love it. Right. Like you said, there's a lot of depth going on here, and it sort of really requires understanding the history. And I'm really curious sort of the level of contemporariness that it must have had in 1980, right? Like how much was this, right? Like stuff that the everyday average person, or maybe just the politically aware person, was aware of or not. But we're about to get to, like, in the last two pages, this story, I think it's safe to say it does something that neither of us ever could have expected. Like we're it's Jewish, but like, it's really, this is like an Israel story. It feels like so far we've got six pages of this like settlement in Israel and like exciting thing. And all of a sudden it's going to make this change because Seraph has clearly won the day on page seven. The attacker is surrendering, but for whatever reason, Seraph is like, I'm not going to fight until I feel like you've been punished the way you deserve.
Yeah, he wants like revenge.
He wants revenge. And he wants revenge for Rivka, who he clearly has the hots for, right? He's like diving in. And then as he's beating this guy up, we suddenly get in huge lettering, a booming voice with from off screen with light behind it going, stop. It's basically, it's a voice of God. It's basically like the rabbis would call this a bat kol, right? The term literally means daughter of voice, but like this is the term used in the Talmud anytime God's voice just like intercedes, right? And then we get more like the text is not quite as big as the stop, but like text that is backlit by this glowing ethereal light.
Like, and the lettering is different. It's like, it's a little, it looks as if someone's talking. I mean,
right. Because it looks like someone talking, but without like the white word balloon around it.
It's just like the words are appearing to you.
Filling the space completely. Right. So this bat kol keeps going and lets Seraph know he could have killed this man. And that would be abusing the gifts and the powers he was given to use justly. It makes me think of God talking to Abraham and thinking like, should not the judge of all the earth do justly, right? Like you are not having these powers to be judge, jury, and executioner, Mr. Seraph, right?
Like when God also scolds, you know, Moses for getting angry.
Right.
And, you know, his punishment is so severe by not being allowed to enter Israel. Like you're the one that everyone's looking up to. You can't act
you
that
can't
way.
You can't behave in this way, right? Yeah. And so this voice, this bat kol, takes away Seraph's powers. He becomes powerless. It's like he cut his Nazarite hair, even though he's not a Nazarite.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it lets Seraph know until he commits repentance, he won't get it. And that's what brings us to the last page and the most like stunning when it comes to Jewish content page we maybe have ever covered.
Yeah, I wasn't emotionally or intellectually prepared for this at all.
Okay, so we're going to go panel by panel.
Yep.
First panel, Chaim is on his knees. He is wearing a white kippah. He's not wearing the mantle of Elijah. What's he wearing, Henry?
He is wearing the sackcloth of biblical days.
Right, so like in the book of Esther, when they're worried that Haman's going to kill all the Jewish people, Mordecai and all the Jews put on sackcloth and ashes, right? In the book of Jonah, and Jonah goes to the town of Nineveh and warns them that God's going to destroy it. In order to do tshuva and do repentance, the king and all the people of Nineveh put on sackcloth and ashes, right? Like, this is biblically he puts on sackcloth, right?
Yeah, he is in a state of mourning.
He's in a state of mourning, right? He's wearing this like very dirty, sort of poor fabric.
Right.
He's asking forgiveness. And he's on his knees and he's saying, hear me, O Lord, I beseech thee to forgive my transgression. And then in the second panel, a close-up of his face with his eyes closed and tears, like gushing tears, tears running down his face as he thinks to himself, I have sinned, and this not even Moses could do with impunity. It was for striking a stone when he was ordered to speak only that Moses was denied entrance into the Holy Land. That's exactly what you're just mentioning, Henry. And what we have another like little note there. What's it tell us?
The full story is in the book of Numbers, chapter 20, verses 7 to 13. Same book, by the way, that mentions the Nazarite too.
Right. And also just worth mentioning, the story is part of the Parshat of Chukat. And in fact, it's the third Aliyah. I like the comparison to Moses here also, because it's a clearly humble character who like, his anger got the best of him once, just this one. Moses hit the rock when he should have just spoken. Here, he like nearly killed a person. It's much worse than what Moses did. And so he gets punished. So he's asking for forgiveness. We get a next panel letting us know that it is now the 10th day of the month of Tishri. So close to Tishrei. Like, I'll take it. And it lets us know, listeners, you probably know, the 10th day of Tishrei, it's Yom Kippur. It's the Day of Atonement. We have this image. Henry, can you describe what he looks like?
It looks like, you know, my dad in Shul in the 70s. Like, it does not look like a superhero. It is a, you know, very neatly cropped beard and hair and white kippah, white talis, tie, an Israeli wearing a tie with right fist clenched over heart. And he starts to say, Kol Nidre.
We have the start of Kol Nidre in this comic. It's amazing.
And he's, you know, and he is ready for a Shamnu too.
Yeah, basically. Absolutely. I was thinking, I was like, it's kind of combining Kol Nidre with like the Vidui, the confession of sins, but like, I'm okay with it. Yeah. It's trying to do in one static image, trying to indicate like the full service. I feel like it's communicating what it needs to.
I will never get this image out of my head. This is the, this might be the most important. I know I throw around a lot of hyperbole, but this might be the most Jewish and like really meaningful Jewish panel in all of comics of all time.
Yeah. A Jewish superhero making repentance because he lost his powers and reciting Kol Nidre right after like crying. Yeah.
Accurately with telling us when on the Jewish calendar Yom Kippur is, like, what? Who is reading this? What kid, what 10-year-old kid or 7-year-old kid is reading this? Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it must have been wild for anybody just reading this as the backup story. Like, yeah. Like, I'm really curious how popular this comic was and how many people must have read it at the time.
Well, you can listen to For All Mankind and they'll tell you all about that stuff.
Okay. The next panel. It continues with like the accuracy because the caption tells us when the blowing of the shofar signals the end of the High Holy Day. Right at the end, like before we get into Ma'ariv and make Havdalah, the last thing we do at the end of Yom Kippur is one final tekiah. We like blow the shofar. I love it that like the shofar signals that the holiday is over and the Bat Kol returns and says, "Your prayers have been heard, Chaim Levon. But never let your passions overcome your judgment again." I also kind of loved it because it reminds me there's like this famous midrash of like, what is God's prayer? And God's prayer is like, may my aspect of mercy overcome my aspect of judgment. Mm. And so it's like the same thing, right? It's like, never let the like judgment and the passions overcome again.
And the implication is that in between those two panels, he has been fasting and praying for 25 hours.
Yeah, he's been doing the full Yom Kippur experience.
The way I read this, and tell me if I'm just, because I want to read it this way, yeah. But the way I'm reading this, it seems to me just by going from the beginning of Yom Kippur to the end, it implies to me that he didn't even like go to sleep, like most of us Jews do, that he has been praying to God all day and all night. And you know,
yeah, like despite, you know what I mean? Despite the suit, it's almost though like he'd be in like what you'd hear these stories of like these shtiebel minions where people are just like literally like they're just so into it and wailing.
Right.
And like, yeah, they're like spending the entire day in tefillah, in prayer, in davening. Yeah.
So that's just how I love it. Yeah.
And as he's forgiven, he's saying, "Blessed art thou, O Lord, King of the universe," which I assume it's translated for our sake, but he's clearly speaking in Hebrew.
Right. Well,
he's saying, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam.
He's making a blessing.
Right. But so it's the beginning.
He's ending. He's maybe making Ha'ma'ariv Arif.
That's my question, Henry. That's my question for you. Yeah. What blessing do you think Chaim is about to say?
Okay, great. What is the final blessing of the day of Yom Kippur?
Before getting into Ma'ariv.
Yeah.
He could be getting ready for Havdalah.
It right.
could be Havdalah.
Okay. Or it could be starting Ma'ariv, Ha'ma'ariv, Ha'ariv. That's yes. I think that was my original.
But he's skipping over Baruch Hu then? Well, anyway, whether we keep this up or not, we move to the next panel where we see Rivka coming up to him. I don't know if he davened alone or if they was like men and women separate or what, but we see these like kind of Hasidic guys with these like big hats.
They're in the background.
They're in the background walking away as Rivka comments like, "Oh, wow. Chaim's been fasting. I guess he like lost some weight."
And she's such like a Jewish mother at that moment. "Oh, Chaim, how thin you are. You have been fasting and lost all your strength."
Right, right. Which like, have they not seen each other at all in the time in between?
Like, what about the break at like 4 o'clock?
Yeah. Anyway, so then Chaim gets the great idea to see if his strength is back.
See if it has returned, Rivka.
And he tests his strength by lifting her up by the
By the tush,
the lower thigh, maybe. Yeah. Reciting, "Hallelujah, my full strength is back." And she's just like, arms are out, like celebrating, loving being carried by him. Those two are gonna go at it that evening.
Well, are they heading to break fast right now, or are they just gonna go straight to
I hope they need a little food. But like, I gotta say, like, the reason he went and lost all the power was to fight. Like, he's a regular King David, this one. Right? Like, he is like Solomon King David. Like, Chaim Levon has a weakness for the women, it appears.
I guess he's like Samson, too, in that way.
Yeah.
So, Brandon, what do you think they're going to go break fast on? What do you think they're going to have? Are they going to have, like, an Ashkenazi meal with, like, kugel and lox and bagels? Or are they going to...
here's the other question.
What is East Sparta you're asking us?
The settlement looked like it was still being built. So, like, I don't assume that they're davening at the settlement. Like, it feels like they went to Jerusalem.
Yeah, it looks like,
right? It looks like they're there.
It looks like they're in Jerusalem. So, even the background of the last panel, you can see a minaret in the back.
So maybe he's going to go get, like, a Jerusalem bagel or something like that.
Go to Pizza Meter.
Well, we've got more stories coming, but that's going to be for part two. That's it for this time. We usually do a review at the end of thoughts, but anything you want to say before we end tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to set ourselves up for disappointment. I think we have hit the most significant Jewish part. I think in our next episode, we might not have the highs of highs that we've had in the last few minutes, but I'm looking forward to seeing more of him, and I'm glad there's a little more of him. But this was incredible. I mean, what a treasure trove of riches.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just really incredible stuff. Just almost a shame that it's this side continuity instead of the mainstream DC continuity. Thank you all for joining us on this adventure as we learned about Seraph. We're going to find out more next time. And until then, I'm Brandon Bernstein.
I'm Henry Bernstein.
No relation.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us at Jewish Comics Pod on Facebook and Twitter, or you can email us at jewishcomicspodcast@gmail.com. Please don't forget to give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can hit the subscribe button if you haven't already.